3 out of 4 Americans see occasional terrorism as part of life in the future. That percentage is up in the wake of last week's bombings in Boston. Is that the future you see? This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today we'll talk about changing public attitudes towards terrorism and how the Boston bombing is affecting the debate over immigration. Also, Lieutenant Governor Kim Reynolds says she will not run for the open U.S. Senate seat in 2014. Our analysts today, Jim McCormick and Stephen Schmidt of Iowa State University. Do you see terrorism as something we simply have to live with? Join our discussion after this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and it's Politics Wednesday on the program today. Stephen Schmidt joining us, University Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University in our Ames studio, alongside Jim McCormick, the Chair of Political Science at Iowa State University. Jim, Stephen, welcome to our program.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Yep, me too.
And as we heard in the top of our news, a memorial service for MIT police officer Sean Collier, whom authorities say was killed in a confrontation with the Boston Marathon bombing suspects going on as we speak. 3 out of 4 Americans see occasional terrorism as a part of life in the future. That's a percentage that is up in the wake of last week's bombings in Boston, according to the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press. 63% of people, Americans, say they followed that bombing very closely, the highest level of interest of any news story in the past decade. The bombings drawing more public attention than any terrorist event since 9/11 in 2001. And, gentlemen, the bombing seeming to confirm that the public has a long-held belief that occasional terrorist acts to be expected. 75% of Americans say that. The previous high of 74% in 2003. We want to reach out to our listeners as we discuss, especially this first half hour, terrorism and politics. Has the Boston bombing changed your attitude about terrorism in the country? Are you one of the 75% of Americans who see occasional terrorism as part of our future? Or do you see things differently than the majority of Americans? And also, do you see an act of terror such as a school shooting like Newtown or a movie theater shooting like in Aurora differently than you see this latest Boston Marathon bombing? Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, rivertoriver at iowapublicradio.org is our email. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Let me start with you, Stephen, in this case, and then go to Jim. I wanted to start with Stephen. As we talk about how public attitudes change about terrorism, have in the last few decades, you've been blogging about this. You're a blogger with WNYC, a regular contributor to the Des Moines Register, and you've been writing about this topic. Also in USA Today, you're saying that the Boston bombing reminded you of growing up in Columbia. There were bombings there?
There were many bombings, and you know, you remember as that grew and was added on to kidnappings, guerrillas taking over much of the country, and really a level of constant insecurity from the day I was born, really, until I, you know, finally went to military school here in the States. And what I said in my column in the Des Moines Register, and it got more emails and even some phone calls from people than I've gotten on any other column, and none of them were hate mail for a change, was, you know, that people were agreeing with me that if you have enough of these kinds of acts, you can't stop the world every time it happens. You can't do what we've been doing, which is to become really very focused on the tragedy in Boston, because they happen frequently enough that it would shut the country down and it would cause the central nervous system to collapse. So my cousins who still live there have simply said, you sort of get used to it. You kind of watch your step. but it becomes part of the environment in which you live, and that simply is incorporated into kind of the general day-to-day routines.
Mm-hmm. Jim McCormick, what are your thoughts on how public attitudes have changed about terrorism in light of this latest bombing?
Well, I think it's really had the genesis with September 11th, because if you look back, you know, the United States just did not have these kind of external events that occurred within our country. And I think that really changed our attitudes. You know, the Department of State has had this terrorism report for about three decades now, where they catalog terrorist acts around the world. And, of course, one of the wonderful things about that is that the United States was virtually insulated from those kind of terrorist acts. If you look at any of the reports, the terrorism acts were mainly in the Middle East, for example. And that's why, you may recall, after 9/11, the Europeans were sort of really taken aback with the Bush administration saying, you are either with us or you're with the terrorists. Because, of course, Europe, over the last previous three decades, had experienced, these kind of periodic terrorism acts. And the kind of singular response on the part of the United States, at least by some public officials in Europe, were considered exceptional here, and they were therefore a little bit reluctant to, and maybe a lot, to embrace this. So I think it's really been since we've experienced this, whether successful or unsuccessful, you know, the Detroit bomber or the attempted bombing of the Detroit plane on Christmas Day, or the New York Times Square efforts. These, even if they're not successful, they have created this kind of new atmosphere, this kind of new culture, this kind of new milieu that Stefan was referring to with regard to his home country.
At this point, from the initial questioning of the surviving suspect and from examination of email, so forth, their activity online, they seem to have had no help from overseas. They learned how to make the pressure cooker bombs, allegedly from an online Al-Qaeda magazine. What difference does that make? Jim, you said just a moment ago these attacks from without, but we have what have been far more serious in terms of fatalities, attacks from within. Timothy McVeigh, for instance, of course, 9/11 being the great exception there. What does the difference does that make, Stefan, when we're attacked from something without than from within?
I think there's a sort of psychological difference. Nationalism kicks in. We are the land of the free and the home of the brave. We have not been attacked even by the Axis powers, except for a few fire bombs that were parachuted across in California and on the West Coast, and a few Germans who landed in submarines and were swiftly caught. And so it is this sense of inviolability. It is the sense that something is breaking when external forces come and do damage to us. If it's internal, I mean, we've had that before. We've had a civil war. We've had anarchists, and we've had many, many tragedies of people for one reason or another killing people with guns and so on. But we know how to deal with those. But there's something more sort of ominous if it comes from abroad. And as you said, you know, we sort of want to know, where did this come from? What other things are they cooking up, and where are they doing it? They're outside of our reach, really.
Right, right. And the big question of why is getting answered in piecemeal fashion as we hear reports of what this surviving suspect is saying. Your thoughts on that, Jim McCormick, as we get this answer?
Well, I think that, sort of ironic, because we talk a lot, and certainly we teach a lot now about globalization and how we're really affected by international events, and in turn our events affect the global environment, you know, this kind of one world here. But I think Stefan is absolutely right that there's still a kind of a psychological barrier, on these particular kind of events, that when we have this, when it's perceived, and I guess maybe that would be a better way to say it, is perceived to have origins abroad, we have not yet made that kind of break. Because as you say, you know, the Timothy McVeigh bombing was obviously much more catastrophic than what happened in Boston. I'm not trying to minimize what happened in Boston, but in terms of the number of people killed. But I do think that there is this kind of psychological break that we have still between perceived foreign and domestic activities.
Politics Wednesday here on River to River. Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, along with Stefan Schmidt of ISU. Mm-hmm. We'd like to have you join our conversation. Your thoughts. What have you heard in the last few minutes that you agree with, that you disagree with? Perhaps you have a different view, another fact, another opinion you'd like to bring in, a question for Stefan or Jim. 1-866-780-9100, River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Tweet us at IPR Talk. Susan joining us from Washington, Iowa. Hi, Susan. Welcome to our program.
Hi, thank you. Since the Boston bombing, I went back and looked at a couple books I had and a documentary, which I haven't had time to go all the way through yet, but it's about the Battle of Algiers and how in the 1950s, you know, France didn't know what to do because this was the way that the Algerians were trying to get their freedom, and they would take bombs and purses and find an Algerian that looked rather French, and they'd take him in a cafe and walk away. And the more women and children they could kill with that, they deemed that as a way to get more attention for their cause. So I think we have been insulated by this kind of thing for a long time, but it's been around since the 1950s.
Comments on Susan's comment, either from Stefan or Jim?
It's really been around before 1950. I mean, throughout history, what we've seen is a ramping up of this as kind of a tool, particularly of these non-state actors. But, in terms of using this kind of an instrument, if I can politely put it that way. And so historically, certainly there have been assassinations throughout history. I mean, these are acts of terrorism, and there's been these kind of, and Stefan cataloged, in Colombia, you know, sort of the kind of what, period of violence. Is that what it's called, Stefan? Or
La violencia, that's right.
Yeah. And so, you know, this is an ongoing, but I think it's a great example of what happened. I mean, the French just did not know what to do. What de Gaulle finally did was to declare victory and pull the French out. I mean, that was ultimately the way that it was addressed.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, yeah, and the other thing is, of course, that there are just untold stories of terrorizing populations going as far back in history as written history. It's a technique that is used to essentially establish supremacy over people, to conquer people, to undermine their solidarity and make them compliant and obedient. And no doubt, many people think that is the ultimate objective of the current wave of terrorism and of what maybe correctly or incorrectly is called a kind of Islamic jihad. Some people think that they're aiming at reestablishing a caliphate, you know, which is a regime and kind of an empire that is ruled by Islamic rulers and Islamic law. And that all, you know, is mixed into this toxic discussion. And so young men in Boston who, you know, seem to have been liked by people and were sort of normal, get inspired by this. And there is even a magazine called Inspire, which promotes that vision, you know, that the infidels are to be harmed and their, you know, their tranquility undermined. So
Inspire, where allegedly the bomb makers learned how to make these pressure cooker bombers. Susan, in Washington, thank you for your call,
thank you.
Observation. 1-866-780-9100. Of course, looking to the future, the trial, who knows when that will take place, but the Obama administration this week announced they would be trying the bombing suspect, Dzhokhar Tsarnaev, in civilian court rather than a military court as an enemy combatant. And South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham has led the criticism of this decision and raised the issue with Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano yesterday when the topic of the older Tsarnaev brother's recent travels to Russia came up.
I would like to talk to you more about this case, how this man left, where he went. And when we say there was no broader plot here, I just don't know how in the world we know that at this early stage.
So, Jim McCormick, when we hear that, as far as the political arguments here go, who has the winning argument in this debate, the Obama administration or critics like we just heard there, Senator Lindsey Graham?
Well, I think in order to have, to treat the suspect as an enemy combatant, you really do have to demonstrate that there are these kind of foreign connections. I'm not sure that just, traveling abroad, even if you go to Chechnya and so on, is a kind of link. And particularly when you're talking about the other brother that apparently, stayed in the U.S. And I think even Senator Graham now acknowledges that you really got to have a demonstrated kind of tie to a foreign group before you could do this kind of enemy combatant and, think about even using military commissions, although given that he's a U.S. citizen, that also would be precluded.
So we're back in this territory of the United States engaged in armed – the question, we are engaged in armed conflict with al-Qaeda, but not all Muslim extremists. So this is familiar territory, Stefan Schmidt.
Yes, and the thing that pushes it along, of course, is the fact that if these two brothers had gone to Norway – there would be very little discussion probably about potential training that they got, or Belgium or someplace like that. I mean, Chechnya and some of the Soviet areas that are – or the former Soviet, now Russian areas that are seeking independence, Ingushetia, Nagorno-Karabakh, are places where there is a huge amount of violence, turmoil, and where terrorist acts of enormous dimensions, much even bigger than the Boston one, have been carried out, and where terrorists are very skillful. They have training camps, and they have supported other jihad uprisings and movements, and they're apparently pretty active even in places like Syria now. So, someone from that part of the world traveling back to that part of the world raises a lot of red flags. I don't care if it's an American or not. And, of course, these boys were actually born there. So I would like to know more. I think everybody wants to know more. And we're processing him as a domestic criminal, a murderer, and so on, the brother that's still alive. But I wouldn't be surprised if we find a few forks in the road that he took when he was there for 6 months that went into some neighborhoods that are suspect.
Okay, let's go to our phones. We have a number of people want to join our conversation. Doug in New Hampton, you're right on this point. You wanted to make a point.
Yes, sir. Thank you. I guess to start off, I am a Republican, but at the same time, I'm very disappointed with the GOP calls for treating this man this American citizen as an enemy combatant.
Why is that?
We as American citizens, we have due process and we have rights, and to just throw all those away, we're riding a very thin line, even playing with fire, I think. And I don't know the honest answer to this. This is just a question, but we've had some terrorist attempts foiled by, I believe, Germany and the UK, maybe even France, I'm not sure, but which is good that those were foiled, but honestly, I don't know the answer, but to what extent is the cost of freedom? If we started, getting rid of the Fourth Amendment or the Fifth Amendment, just, because of these potential threats, I mean, what gain do we really have if we're losing those rights? Because we can't watch everybody.
Okay, Doug.
There's 100 ways to make a bomb.
So. Sure, this is Stefan. Can I make a really quick comment on that?
Sure.
Yes.
Well, that's what we said as I was growing up in Colombia. And the more the guerrillas and narco-traffickers and private armies and kidnappers and terrorists essentially really just made life unbearable, the more people basically supported very, very tough and strong government actions, even if, as they said, a few innocent people are basically stepped on. And that's the great danger. I mean, that's my conclusion in my column in the Des Moines Register, is that if these things begin to accumulate and people really are essentially frightened every day. People are willing to give up a lot of their civil liberties in order to crush what is to them a much more dangerous and imminent threat. And, you know, that's the real risk here.
No, okay. In one way, yep. May I add a comment?
Yeah, sure. Go ahead, Jim.
In one way, we had an example of that already, and even the criticism of the lockdown that took place in Boston for virtually at least the whole day here, where they locked down the city. And you know, this was raised by some as, did this really go too far? You know, and that's sort of just one little component of this picture that
And yet crowds cheered upon the release
Absolutely.
Of that lockdown and thanked their law enforcement.
Yeah, I mean, this is the kind of what I would say is kind of the security freedom trade-off, you know, when you get into these situations. Where is the middle ground on this? And as you correctly say, while there was some carping about this sort of lockdown and couldn't leave your house and so on, there was this great outpouring of flags waving and chanting USA and so on at the time of the capture.
Okay, Doug, thank you for getting us into that territory. Doug from New Hampton,
thank you.
Let's go to Jenna in Ames quickly before we come up to a break. Hi, Jenna. What's on your mind?
Well, it's sort of along the same line, the discussion about I've been trying to call Lindsey Graham and ask him a question. If he would be willing to try our homegrown terrorists, which we have in our, you know, Aryan Nation and white supremacists, they're blowing up things and killing people and so forth all the time. Does he also want to try them as an enemy combatant? And there is, you know, it's a question that I had, and so that's where I'm going with this. But my question was along the same line as the fellow that just spoke.
Okay, Jenna, thank you for your call from Ames. We appreciate it. 1-866-780-9100. As we finish up this, gentlemen, in the next half hour, we want to talk about how this bombing in Boston has changed or shaped the shape of the immigration debate in Washington and in this country. Before we do that, any concluding remarks as we talk about the aftermath of this bombing politically?
Yes. We are now issuing drones to police departments and to other security agencies in this country. And for the time being, they say, well, they're just going to be for surveillance. But as you know, Rand Paul and others have raised the question, well, you know, if we have a situation that is imminent, where we know that these two brothers in Boston, we are almost 99.9% sure that they are going to blow up an explosive device, we can paint them, we can target them, we have them on a drone, what do we do? Mm-hmm. Do we let them go ahead and commit this mayhem? Or does the president or maybe even someone below the president say, go ahead and kill, because the risk of violating an American's life, civil liberties, is much less than the risk of having mayhem. Who knows? They might have a nuclear explosive device that they plan to blow up in a suitcase bomb or something. So these are real scenarios, and I think we have to think about them.
Okay, very good. Leading into our next question, perhaps we'll talk about President Obama, how he's handled terrorism, how his handling of terrorism has evolved. He's pursued a policy of speaking softly and ordering lots of drone strikes. We'd like to have you join our conversation as we continue talking about terrorism and politics. Also, this latest bombing's effects shaping of our immigration debate when we come back. 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. The Boston bombing caused some to call for a slowing of the legislative process currently underway toward comprehensive immigration reform legislation. Do you agree with that? Or do you think it's all the more reason we need to overhaul, to fix immigration in this country? Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk or find us on Facebook and put a post up there with your question, your opinion. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio. Politics Day, Stephen Schmidt and Jim McCormick of Iowa State University. Stay with us. Back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Politics Wednesday here. Stephen Schmidt and Jim McCormick of Iowa State University with us as our analysts. 3 out of 4 Americans see occasional terrorism as part of life in the future. That's according to the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press, a percentage that is up in the wake of last week's bombings in Boston. Has it changed your attitude about terrorism in this country? 1-866-780-9100. We want to go to the calls. We want to also talk about this bombing's aftermath, the impact on the immigration debate in Washington. But first of all, as promised, I want to ask, go to Jim McCormick, first of all. Do you see, when we talk about the president's handling of terrorism, he wasn't shy about invoking Osama bin Laden's killing during the 2012 campaign. He's pursued a policy of perhaps speaking softly, but he has ordered a lot of drone strikes. Do you see an evolution in his approach to terror?
I really don't. I think that he's really stayed the course. I think he's ramped it up with these drone strikes. I was on here a couple or 3 weeks ago, and we talked about the increase in the number of drone strikes that the Obama administration has pursued. I think the strategy clearly is not to make this and not to cause too much alarm in the public or in the larger international community about how the United States is going to respond to terrorism, but at the same time using a very tough policy in terms of attacking cells that, that can be identified and that can be, in this sense, taken out. So I don't see it an evolution here. I think that from almost day one that he took office, he wanted to have a public posture that was more, if you will, conciliatory to the rest of the international community, even as he was using special operations and using counterterrorism measures to continue the policy, in my view, of the Bush administration, and in some ways ramping it up and using a little bit different technique.
But again, Stefan Schmidt here, if, in fact, we believe that drone strikes are an effective way of fighting terrorism, that was a smart thing to do. If we believe, as many analysts do, that drone strikes are highly counterproductive, that they make as many enemies, yeah, they kill terrorists here and there. You know, they knock out people. But for every terrorist that's knocked out, it offends a lot of people in the countries where this takes place. You know, nobody wants drones flying over their country. And collateral damage often occurs, and it produces for every child or woman or other person who is not an enemy combatant who is taken out by a drone, it produces six or seven new people who will join the jihad. So there's some real doubt as to whether in the long term this is really sustainable. I mean, the one thing it does, it protects Americans who might otherwise have to go on the ground with boots on the ground to take out these individuals. And that's good for the American soldiers and intelligence people. But I don't think we have the evidence yet that drones, you know, except for surveillance and command and control, are an effective tool to on the terrorism end of it.
Stefan and Jim, let's go to Tally in Marion. And Tally's joining us. Tally, you're asking the question today, has this Boston bombing changed your outlook, your attitude about terrorism in this country?
Hi. Yeah, thank you. I, as a college student, and I guess my concern feels, you know, a little bit impertinent, but as I consider, you know, relocating for jobs and things like that, I live in a decent-sized town, but it raises to me concerns regarding security. And, I mean, I don't think that these concerns are, like, completely prohibitive. I mean, I feel like, you know, while these events are happening more and more, they're not happening, you know, in, like, heaven forbid, like, three times a day. So, I mean, it will have a bearing on my job search and my future plans, but I feel reasonably safe.
Mm-hmm. So what I hear you're saying is it's given you second thoughts about moving to a major population center.
Indeed.
Okay. Tally, thank you very much calling
from
Marion. Let's talk a little bit about immigration, the immigration debate, how that dovetails, interweaves with this story, the Boston bombing, causing some call for the slowing of the legislative process currently underway on comprehensive immigration reform legislation. First to make that argument, before any suspects were named, was Iowa Congressman Steve King. Though our own Republican Senator Chuck Grassley drew some criticism for raising the issue at a Senate hearing last week, and this week he compared his arguments to those being raised over the fertilizer plant explosion in West Texas.
I don't hear any criticism of people when there's 14 people killed in West Texas, and demanding, taking advantage of that tragedy to warn about more government action to make sure that fertilizer factories are safe.
And to Senator Grassley's assertion that the Boston bombing should be a consideration in debating immigration reform led to this rather heated exchange between Grassley and Senator Chuck Schumer of New York, who is one of the sponsors of immigration reform.
I say that particularly those who are pointing to what happened, the terrible tragedy in Boston, as I would say, excuse for not doing a bill or delaying it many months or years.
I never said that.
I didn't say you did.
I never said that.
I didn't say you did, sir.
Okay. Does the Boston bombing have a place in the immigration reform debate? Jim McCormick.
Sure. This is a question of people that have come to the United States, what kind of standards were applied in terms of them entering the country, getting a green card or getting citizenship. I think it has a rightful place. I mean, certainly in terms of it, you look at the immigration bill, this 844-page bill that was introduced. The first thing it talks about is sort of border control, and that is to be the item that will be the kind of the trigger, as it's called, although that language is really not new. It's been around for some time in other immigration bills. And that would be the precursor, if you will, in terms of path to citizenship and the other kind of visa reforms that are called. So I don't think it is exceptional that it would have an impact on the immigration debate.
Yesterday, we saw supporters of immigration reform trying to reframe this debate over security and immigration reform. Here again, one of the Republican co-sponsors of the bill, Senator Lindsey Graham, who has said that a new immigration system would bring 11 million undocumented immigrants out of the shadows, in his words.
All the hijackers in 9/11 were visa overstays. And if Boston tells us anything, we need to be aware of who's living among us, whether they're native-born or come in on a visa and become a citizen. Well, we can be threatened by our own people.
Stephen Schmidt, you have a lot to do with the immigration debate, also expertise in Latin America. Who is making the better political argument on this decision?
Well, Steve King sent me an email just a few minutes ago, and it says, "Dear friend, there is only one word you need to know about the Gang of Eight's immigration legislation, amnesty, with an exclamation mark." And then he goes on to say that we need to stop this immediately. We need to send him $25, $50, or $100 or more to his campaign to fight against this. So I think the Republicans, have serious problems with immigration reform, except for the part that deals with border security. There is almost no interest in providing a path to citizenship or what they call essentially amnesty. And so this is a terrific moment to once again make immigration and immigrants seem like a threat. You know, these kids that came to the United States would not have been denied, I think, access to the United States and residency if we had, the world's tightest immigration reform, because they were not a threat to the United States, apparently, until very recently. Mm-hmm. And so, it wouldn't have made any difference. And immigration reform is really about a lot of people coming to the United States and, quote, taking away American jobs and coming to the United States and taking advantage of welfare and emergency rooms and medical facilities and overloading the school systems in Texas and Arizona and Florida and California and so on. That's what it's really about.
Stephen Schmidt and Jim McCormick with us from Iowa State University, our analysts for this edition, Politics Wednesday edition of River to River. Gentlemen, let's go back to the phones. A lot of interest in our topic today. Frederic in Alcater. Hi, Frederic. We know each other. Thank you for joining our conversation.
Thanks for taking my call, Ben. I really appreciate it. The events of the past week in Boston are sort of personal to me at many levels. At first, my dad is of a Muslim faith. I grew up in a household that was Muslim and Roman Catholic. I associate myself with the faith, and you cannot help but hope that the perpetrators, whenever you hear about something like this, are not Muslims. Unfortunately, that was not the case, but that's neither here nor there. Also, I called Boston home for about 13 years before moving back to Iowa. In fact, I moved. I lived on Boylston Street, a block away from where the events took place. So this whole thing hit me like a ton of brick. Honest to God, each time I hear words uttered out of the mouth of Representative King, and unfortunately out of Senator Grassley this time around, I'm embarrassed to call myself an Iowan. This idea that that we need to stall the immigration debate because of the events is just insane to me. If anything, because these guys were part of the system, they were able to be identified really quickly. The second brother didn't get his citizenship because the system worked, in my opinion. That we have 11 million people put their heart and soul in this country in the betterment of our society. The idea that we need to punish them because of the act of two nuts and their perverted interpretation of religion is just insane to me.
Frederick, thank you for calling with your opinion as a Muslim American and a Muslim Iowan from Elkader, the only, which you pointed out in this program before, the only town in Iowa named after a Muslim leader, actually, Elkader. Thank you, Frederick.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate the debate as well.
Tom is joining us from Fort Dodge. Hi, Tom.
Yeah, hi. Listen, I was listening to you, and I haven't heard it yet on this program, and I don't know as I've really heard it at all ever. Have we even given any thought to exploring the possible causes of terrorist attacks? I'm not crazy. I would expect that there would be, you know, some terrorism, even in the best of worlds. But when we don't take enough of an interest to know what we're doing as a country and what our country is doing in our name, how can we ever hope to address the problem? And this is a problem.
Yeah, Tom, I think actually Jim McCormick did bring that up in reference to the drone strikes, that there could be a factor there that or was it Stefan?
Stefan will claim that.
That's right.
Stefan will claim that.
That's right.
So that they could be doing more harm than good, Tom.
Oh,
I don't know if you caught that part of the program.
Well, I couldn't agree with them more that they very well could be. The heck of it is. We have very little citizen awareness of, you know, where we are, what we're doing, or what is being done in our name.
Tom.
And I'm anything but un-American.
Tom, thank you for your opinion.
Thank you.
From Fort Dodge, 1-866-780-9100. I wonder if we can ask this question. We heard Lindsey Graham there, Democratic senator. Can the GOP, which has historically won the national security argument, support immigration reform now? It seems to be debated in the party, a split in the party.
Yeah, I just wanted to add one thing. I mean, I think this business of, you know, saying that you can't even talk about, you know, the kind of border issues or immigration in the context of an immigration bill is really over the top. I mean, of course you should talk about that. And I think what Senator Grassley is saying, if I can just defend him for a moment, is he just wants to have that on the table. Even Senator Graham has said that. And so the idea that even talking about and juxtaposing these events is problematic. It seems a little bit really off track. I mean, surely the Gang of Eight that put together this bill wants to fast track, and they want to get everything that they want get done. At the same time, they said this would be done in the normal process, and the normal process is to review these things. So I don't think this is an exceptional for the U.S. Senate, you know, the most deliberative body in the country or in the world, as it proclaims itself. So I think this, you know, some of these comments about you can't even talk about this is simply off track.
Okay. Let's move on. We have about 5 minutes left of our discussion, gentlemen, and we wanted to talk about the Senate, some developments there since we last had a Politics Wednesday here on the program. Montana Democratic Senator Max Baucus announcing yesterday, I believe, he would not be running for reelection. He has served in the Senate since 1978. He says he's not done yet, though.
A lot of work ahead of us. During this next year and a half, I'm going to be just re-energized, refocused. It's Farm Bill. It's a Highway Bill. It's Eastern Front. It's also tax reform. It's get the debt done. There's so much work to be done, and without campaigning now, I'll have a lot of time freed up to get it done. So I'm just very grateful. A lot of work ahead of us, and could not be more excited.
Okay, how is his retirement likely to impact his effectiveness in the Senate? How does that generally happen then, Stefan?
Well, I think, he's moving on to become a lobbyist, and that is remarkable and wonderful. He has his causes, and he'll be hired by some, pretty important organizations. But the main thing is that a lot of people are bailing out of the Senate because it's become basically an impossible place to do business. I mean, it's gridlock. You can't get any appointments through because you can have secret holds on presidential appointments, and you don't even know who's stopping and somebody who's being nominated to be confirmed from coming up. You have a filibuster that is being totally abused and is unconstitutional. Someone needs to sue the Senate for essentially abusing its power to have filibusters because it is not what the founders intended. It's not in the Constitution, of course. And it's a place of people yelling at each other. I wouldn't be surprised if at some point we start having duels again because these people really are running hot, and the left and the right, or at least the right and the Democrats, are at each other's throats, and there is no civility left. And that's why Steve King probably won't run for the Senate, because it is not a pleasant place to be anymore, and that's a great tragedy.
Well, let's talk about the open Senate seat left by retiring Senator Harkin. Steve King has not said whether he will or he won't, but we know a little more this week about who will not be seeking to fill that retiring that seat of the retiring Democratic Senator Tom Harkin here in Iowa. Lieutenant Governor Kim Reynolds announced yesterday she would not seek the Republican nomination, saying she was excited to continue work in the Branstad administration. But Agriculture Secretary Bill Northey has not yet ruled out a run.
I really believe that politically it could be done. I believe it could work for me and lots of other people. I certainly believe it could have worked for Kim, and I know it could work as well for the congressman.
Okay, so Jim McCormick, comment on how soon the Republicans need to settle on a candidate, because the Democrats have Bruce Braley. He's got a long runway before he has to take flight, and he's shining up his plane, putting all the baggage on there. He's ready for flight, isn't he?
He is. I think, over the next, I would say, 3 to 4 months, I mean, certainly by the end of the summer, it would be good for the Republicans to have identified a candidate here. I think what they're really trying to do is to avoid a primary fight here, and is sort of this maneuvering by and use of the press here. I wouldn't actually put King out of this yet. I mean, the argument is, well, he hasn't raised very much money, and therefore he's not really pursuing this. But on the other hand, you think about it, he's getting an awful lot of free publicity, and we're talking about him again today, and Stefan talked about his tweet earlier or email earlier asking for some money. I have also said all along, I think Northey is probably going to be the candidate, and the reason is that he's won a couple statewide elections here, and he has an image that probably could win some votes over in Eastern Iowa.
You mean a more moderate image than
right.
Steve King?
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you sit on that, Stefan Schmidt? Bill Northey, a good possibility for the GOP?
I asked him this past weekend at this retreat conference, and he wouldn't answer any questions about that. He gave a great presentation about water quality in Iowa, which he's very interested and concerned about. How about Joni Ernst from Red Oak, or Iowa Secretary of State Matt Schultz? Their names have popped up as well. Mm-hmm. So I think if the Republicans want not to have a contested primary, they may have something else coming, because if Steve King doesn't run, it really breaks wide open the whole process. I mean, Congressman Latham was sort of the front runner for many people, decided not to do it. Steve King has an incredibly visible, powerful position in the House. That will never change. No one will ever defeat Steve King in that 4th district. And why would he give up a podium from which he can essentially project his position on a lot of issues very powerfully and be on all the Sunday talk shows to take a risk running for the Senate. And even if he got elected to the Senate, you know, some of that would probably disappear because he would have Ted Cruz and a bunch of other senators who are in a way much heavier weight than he is, including Marco Rubio and others, overshadowing him. So, you know, if you're a really visible individual in an institutional position, why not build that and use that to the maximum?
Okay.
That's my view, anyway.
All right, thank you, both for your views this hour. We'll see, because Iowa is it not more the unusual state that has had such a long time, for decades, one Democrat and one Republican as senators. We'll see if this continues or if that changes with the open Senate seat in 2014. Stephen Schmidt, Jim McCormick of Iowa State University. We appreciate, as always, having you on the program. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you very much.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Technical support from Dennis Reese. In Ames, we had help from Garrett Van Leeuwen. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. You can always find a podcast of this program if you're interested in hearing the whole program again, or perhaps you only caught part of it and want to hear the whole hour. Go to iowapublicradio.org. You'll find River to River in the Iowa Public Radio news section. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.